Hello, and thank you for welcoming me in your consciousness. I know that sounds a bit creepy, and I'm sorry, but speaking about consciousness, this episode really is a lot along those lines. We go very deep into consciousness and how it relates to something sounding even more serious, quantum mechanics. Luckily, our guest is very well positioned to talk about both subjects because he is both a physicist and a Zen Buddhist. And something worth noticing is that even though we looked at the central question of who or what are we from a very different perspective, as with the last guest, Professor Lieven Annemans, who is really an expert on studying happiness, you might notice that the underlying messages are really similar. They both say, be kind, choose compassion, and I think that's just wonderfully in line with the mission of this podcast, and I couldn't be happier with it. So I am here with Radu Surduno, if Surdiano, I say that directly. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Can you maybe quickly introduce yourself in any way you find appropriate?
Yeah, it's difficult. You put the question before, right? And I could say, well, I'm a physicist for formation. I am a Zen practitioner and a haponymist.
What exactly is a haponymist?
Haponymy comes from happiness and economy. So the economy of happiness.
Some and things that might not be very compatible, which a lot of people
not straightforward, you would think. And especially at that time. In 5 years ago, there was not so many movements. Now you see in New Zealand, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Prime Minister of Scotland, looking at this, Canada also looking at this, more haponymy for the happiness of people.
Okay, that's very interesting. I think the mission of this podcast is by looking at ourselves from multiple angles to maybe become a little bit more happy in the process. So I think that's very interesting and maybe something for our listeners to explore more. So I will ask you a very simple question to start with. It is, who or what are we?
Very simple, the most tricky question ever, right? And
the thing is, I cannot even answer it myself.
No,
I just annoy other people with it.
I don't think anybody can say himself, you know, or herself, you know, who are we, or if knows exactly. I think everybody has his own, his, her own story about it. And it's a question of evolution. How do you evolve along your life, and how do you grow along your life? And then you will have different answers during your lifetime. And this is why one of the subjects that we wanted to do in TEDx in Leuven, it was to have, you know, 10, 11 speakers from different generations to see how they will perceive our society and how they would look at the future at different stages in their life. And lastly, I think 2 weeks ago, I found out that one of the haponymists sat online one of the TED Talks about a Swedish guy who wanted to understand why the Swedes are so, I mean, why the Scandinavian countries are ranking so high on the happiness level. And it was a surprise to me. I didn't know about it. It's called also the Scandinavian Secret. So he wrote a book.
Yeah, they're very famous for it.
For it. And then he said that in the 19th century, they had few visionary leaders, political leaders, who said, look, if you want to change a country, if you want to change the system, you have to start with the people. Mm-hmm. And then they created this camps of for inner growth for people, where they explained, you know, various facets of being happy, of being fulfilled, and so on. So they looked at, you know, meditation, they looked at sports, they looked at, you know, physical activity, intellectual activity, mental activity, spiritual activity, as well as, which I find it's from a physicist, from a scientist point of view, also interesting, explaining to people, making them aware what technology can do for you.
Okay.
And they were Scandinavia at that time. It was very agrarian, very poor. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with the industrial revolution and everything. They explained, look, this is what it can do for you. So you get this awareness and also embedded in your inner growth to make use of technology as well, apart from all the other aspects.
That's very interesting. So you said, because of my background in physics, that's maybe also an interesting angle to look at the question, who or what are we? So if you would try to be a physicist now at this moment, how would you answer the question?
Yeah, that's a very good one that you say, because I cannot be anymore just a physicist, right? I mean, you are how you develop along the way. And physics totally attracted me because of a teacher I had in high school, who actually, the more I read about Richard Feynman, one of the physicists who had a Nobel Prize. A lot of physicists love him. He's a Nobel Prize winner, but at the same time, he could explain physics in very simple words to everybody, mm-hmm. right? And this is great. And my teacher in high school, he was like this, and the way he taught physics, it was exactly like Richard Feynman was saying, we should teach physics and science and whatever we want to teach kids. You give them a wonder. Mm-hmm. And you blow their minds with a wonder, and then you start explaining how this wonder can happen.
Yeah,
and this is how I learned physics. And then I said, okay, this is fantastic. This is what I want to do. This is my path. I'm still very happy that I chose that path, because it creates a way of thinking that in the end, and maybe we will come later to this question, is quite missing in the society we live now, and the scientific mind, the scientific approach to all the issues, to the news, to fake news, but also on the streets. You know, if you talk to people and you say, this is what science is saying about this subject, and these are, scientifically proven things, and they say, well, this is just your opinion. You know, there's not science, you don't need to believe it. It is like it is.
Yeah,
like, so science, there is no question of faith in about it. So that's what...
Actually, there's a very big aspect of doubt. It's doubting yourself all the time.
Yes.
Science, it's the opposite of blind faith.
Exactly. And then if I go to Richard Feynman, what Richard Feynman did, I don't know if you know it, that he had a friend of his. He was a painter, and he was a physicist, but he wanted to learn how to paint. And they said, okay, let's try to meet for a few months, for a few weeks. Let's see how it goes. Every Sunday, you teach me how to do sketches, how to draw, how to paint. And the other weekend, the other Sunday, I'm going to teach you physics. And they started for a few weeks to do this, and then they stopped when one of them died. Basically, they kept it all along for the entire life. And then what Richard Feynman said is, like, look, you are looking at the flower because it's beautiful and it's yellow, mm-hmm. and it has a middle is blue or whatever. You look at the flower. But the way I look at the flower, I look from a totally different point of view. Look at the mathematics describing how the seeds are there. Look at the physics of everything. Mm. Look at the chemistry that makes the flower blue. He had a totally different view of the same object.
It's probably one of the most inspiring YouTube videos of all time.
Yeah.
I think if you take 5 minutes to Google funny cats, you should take 5 minutes to look at that video. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, and I mean, also the videos of Richard Feynman, they're only 1.5 minutes, and it explains you a concept that sticks with you for your entire life. Yeah, so the thing about science is that this is what we miss now, in as far as I could see, that we miss this scientific approach to stuff that we read, to stuff that we encounter, and so on. And the The toughest thing is that Feynman already said this like 40 years ago. I had the same impression about society at that time, that science is becoming irrelevant for the society. And that's
okay.
That's
I didn't know he said that.
Yeah, he said it, and it was in a talk he gave in Italy, on at a conference, and I was shocked to see. I mean, the speech that he gave then, he could give it now. So the thing is I chose physics because it was, you know, the teacher was bringing me wonders and explaining me the wonders and so on. And then when I was 18, I started meditating and studying Zen and martial arts. And then I realized physics and Buddhism, they fit so well. But for me, it gave me a purpose as a person, because I was developing on both, you know, intellectually being a physicist and then studying and going abroad and doing PhDs and in physics, and on the other hand, still practicing meditation and getting more and more into the Buddhism and the concepts. And then I realized more and more how incredibly linked these are. And of course, the best example is Mathieu Ricard as a scientist.
Yes, he is brilliant. And he has written the book The Quantum and the Lotus
with the other physicist, the Vietnamese physicist, and that's brilliant. I mean, the book is
yeah, it's
fantastic.
One of my favorites.
Yeah,
I even bought it in paperback.
It's fantastic. I mean, that book is fantastic. And what I really liked is about the initiative of Dalai Lama to have science for monks. That Dalai Lama meets every year with scientists from different fields, and then he wants to listen what the progress is in science. And then there are a lot of professors who go to teach the Buddhist, you know, the Tibetan monks about science. And that's a professor from Arizona, actually, who wrote a book on it, Chris Impen. And he went there and he described his experience as an astrophysicist teaching the monks. And what struck him really, it was the attention span that the Buddhist monks have. They can listen to you for 8 hours, completely focused and concentrated to you.
I remember in my student years, I think the average attention span was between 5 and 8 seconds.
Yeah, so. Exactly, yeah. So do you know, I mean, and now people are bashing the millennials. You know what the attention span is apparently of the millennials, if you start talking to one? It's about 8 seconds.
That's more than I thought.
But and then they just go. Yeah. They just go. But if you get their attention within these 8 seconds, they can go really deep into the subject.
Ah, okay.
And that's the trick.
That's interesting.
If we can have an elevator pitch of 8 seconds for the millennials, that would be fantastic. Then we can grab the attention of this generation. And then one of the other things is what I really liked about this book on science for monks, that he was explaining, is that the attention span of the monks is so large, but also the debating culture that is in the Buddhism, that you respectfully debate about the subject with your opponent. So the one that has an opponent view on that particular subject.
And it's interesting because a lot of religions, they leave no room for doubt whatsoever.
No.
And
yeah.
Buddhism seems to be the one exception that says to you, you know, you have to question this. Don't take my word
exactly.
for it.
Exactly. And that's like science, right? And then the scientist is always open. Look, I mean, you have an idea, right, in science. And then you say, look, this is my idea. I think this is what's happening. But then you have to have a sort of alter ego in your mind saying this is not true and come up with all the arguments possible against your idea. Once you finished up with your alter ego, then you start talking to different people from different fields, try to challenge you on your idea. And then you get a lot of information and to build up your theory. And then you go to the next step and you construct your theory, having all these views from everything, and then you start experimenting. But you're still open to the results of experiment. It can lead to the fact that, yes, your theory is right, which is great. You can publish in Nature, Physics of Letters, mm-hmm. and so on. Or you can say, well, you're wrong, and you're totally wrong, which can happen. But as a scientist, you have to be open to this, that, look, I am wrong, I'm moving on. And what I like is that the next step, let's say you're successful as a physicist or as mm-hmm. a scientist, you have a brilliant theory, and then you put it in practice, and it's your theory is in line with the experiments, but not only with your experiments, with two other labs or labs around the world that they check your experiment, and then your theories and experiment they fit, and you made your dent in the universe, like mm-hmm. Steve Jobs said, right? Yeah. You made your dent in the universe. But then this is a nice one, and this is also one of the nice concepts in Buddhism. You detach from it. You're non-attached to your idea that you changed the world, and then you move on to something else. It's not about you. And then, you know, we were talking before the interview about consciousness. You know, you just added to the consciousness something, but then you're non-attached to your idea, because actually it's not only your idea. You didn't come up with that.
Yeah, it's just... it's the end result of a puzzle that's been going on inside your mind for maybe years and years. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, they hold on to their idea because it's ego. Because
it's ego. Yeah.
If they are wrong, what would it mean to them? And what would it mean about them? And I think in that aspect, Buddhism is very interesting because it really makes you question, what is the self? Like, is it something constant, fixed? Like, there's an interesting aspect about Buddhism called impermanence.
Yes.
I don't know in Zen Buddhism how you would define impermanence.
Well, everything changes. So there is, this is one of the basic concepts, right? That everything changes. So of course everything is impermanent. So you're not.
And also everything changes in physics because our bodies change, our chemicals change, but then these chemicals are made of particles and subatomic particles, and then there's a question of maybe it's all strings vibrating like a violin, so maybe there's nothing else than change.
I mean physics is, and science in general, is very young. At a very young, we are just as kids playing with science. I mean, if you look at, you know, all these billions of years that we exist, and we have for a few hundred years, we have science, right? We are just beginning.
Yeah, the scientific method is relatively new.
Yeah, it's very new. And, you know, the fact that we know only 4% of the universe, that's mind-boggling, right? And then, so indeed, what we have done with science is fantastic up to now. And then I was talking with Robert Dykraff, I don't know if you know him, he's the head of the Princeton Institute, where these Nobel Prize winners are there, and they are paid to take a walk in the woods, and he's the director of that.
And they're paid to take a walk in the woods?
In the woods, and come up with great ideas,
Okay.
Right? And he's the director of that institute. Yeah. And he was saying, look, since in the last 15 years, if you were to study physics now at the same level of detail as I studied in the 90s, beginning of the 90s, then you would have to study for 100 years to cover all the progress that we have done in the last 15 years.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's absolutely amazing.
I think this is the right moment to dig a bit deeper into physics. One interesting thing is Foucault's pendulum. So he is the guy who, in the Pantheon in Paris, he put a pendulum there on the ceiling, and he let it swing, and he noticed that actually the plane in which the pendulum swings, it changes direction, and he thought, that must be weird. How is that? And then he proved that actually it is because the Earth is rotating around its own axis. So I hope that's nothing new for our listeners. The Earth is round, by the way. It's not flat.
For most of the people, yes.
For most of the people. What is the truth? And we can go on about that as well. But it gets a bit more interesting like that. Suppose you are at the North Pole and you let it swing there, then the earth below the pendulum would do a full turn in 24 degrees. But then the question is actually the plane of the pendulum, is that the thing that is shifting? Or is it actually the earth? Because it's an illusion, because actually the pendulum is not shifting. And the amazing thing about it is that actually the pendulum is in perfect alignment with the whole universe. So I think that is, it's very interesting, because the earth moves around the sun moves around the center of the Milky Way moves around a black hole. So the pendulum is kind of magically able to stay in line with the rest of the universe. And the further you would fixate the pendulum as a reference point, let's say you take the furthest galaxies known to us, the shift would be very, very minimal. So I think that's very relatable to the concept of interdependence. Like, how is it possible that a little pendulum here on Earth is in a straight contact with the end of the universe? Because we have the principle of localism, which says that an object is only influenceable by its immediate surroundings. But it's kind of mind blowing, I think.
Yeah, it's, well, you're going to the direction that it's one of the subjects that I really like, on that one particle can fill the other, can have the same properties of another particle, even though they are as a distance so far away that they, according to Einstein, the information could not travel between those two particles.
You're talking about the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox.
And then this is what Einstein said, look, this is not possible, because not even information can travel faster than the speed of light, right? But then there are experiments that show that the two photons that can split from one photon, that they go, so you have basically twice the speed of light, they can still have the same property, so they can feel each other at a distance.
Yeah, it's amazing, because so, for listeners that are not aware, what if you have a particle that disintegrates, and then because of the law of symmetry, it goes in both the opposite directions, and then suddenly photon A is measured, and because a particle behaves like a wave, until it's measured, it's like a drop of water.
It can behave as a wave or a particle, depending how you measure it. But the nice thing about this one is that, so okay, you have for particles, but then this is not at the macroscopic level, right? Mm-hmm. So you cannot say that. At this moment, from the information that what you have up to now, it cannot explain telepathy, for example. Or that you feel another
only
person that
God
is across
is
the ocean,
is the
or
only
whatever.
Right explanation for telepathy,
so,
of course.
Yeah. So, but this cannot be explained scientifically at this moment, just because of this party. However, there was an experiment, I think 1.5 year ago, where they show that this states that two systems, and it was with two systems of 16 million particles.
Okay.
And they could still have the same properties at larger distances. So this gives hope that we can show this with science. But this goes into the other topic that is that you probably know it, right, on the holographic principle of the universe.
Can you elaborate a bit on that?
It started with Gerard Hooft in Utrecht in the Netherlands. But it was picked up by Leonard Susskind in Stanford. And then they said, look, if you have a black hole, the information that goes into a black hole, if objects fall in the black hole, they are three-dimensional. So there is three-dimensional information going to the black hole. But all the information about what it is in the black hole is on the event horizon of that black hole, which is a two-dimensional object. So 3D information can be degraded to only 2D information. So basically what's in the black hole is a hologram, right?
Okay.
But then if you expand it more, then you say, well, our event horizon of our universe is only 2D, is also 2D, but what we perceive here is a 3D, well, 4D if you take time, right? So basically we are a hologram. Mm-hmm. The entire universe is a hologram. And this is an amazing concept, no? And the theory and the model, they are ready. I mean, they're clearly made up to now. Now it's just a scientific proof. And how do you do the scientific proof? Hmm. And there's the controversy now. Because some people say, look, we can go down to the Planck length and then we can check if you have a blurry universe at the Planck length. But some people say, well, this is not the way to prove this this model, which is it's explained with string theory. But this is very nice, because then you say, well, everything is an illusion in this universe, which fits again with the Buddhist views.
Yes, exactly.
That everything is an illusion.
They are very passionate about their illusion, the Buddhists. They even go so far into telling us that without consciousness, there can be no physical world.
Yes. Yeah, because and this goes also to the quantum world, right? You have an infinity of possibilities around you, and the moment you measure it, it is one reality. So out of this infinite number of possibilities that you have, because you looked at it, you make one reality, which is an illusion, of course, because you have all these infinite possibilities. But you make the reality because of the consciousness that you say, that the awareness of what you have around you.
The question is, of course, how do we define consciousness?
True. Nobody knows. No, I don't think
the anybody interesting dares, thing is that we are able to ask that question about ourselves. So consciousness is really able to look at itself and question it.
Yeah.
I think that's a miracle that already, you would need years and years to explain, I think.
But this goes into if you say it like this, that consciousness looks at itself and asks what it is, sounds like a fractal thing, right? So you're going deeper in it, and this is what it is. I mean, hologram is a fractal thing.
And like you could ask, for instance, you notice a bottle of water, you could ask, who's noticing? Then you could ask, who's noticing the noticing? Then who's noticing the noticing the noticing?
And there
you could go on forever and ever, and at some point you'll get bored and say, okay, I will just accept that I cannot explain it. Because I think that's the difference between Buddhism and science. Like, Buddhism accepts that some things are maybe not explainable, whilst science says we should be able to explain everything. And that's another question that I'm wondering about is, are we only able to understand the universe with our consciousness? Does that limit us? Because our consciousness comes from our neurobiology, and our neurobiology has been made this way because of evolution and because we wanted to survive. But that's a very, very limited toolkit we have to understand the universe. We were not made to understand quantum physics. It doesn't help that much with survival, at least at the moment.
I don't know yet. Mm-hmm. We don't know yet. We don't know at this point. And then the way we look at the universe now is with our five senses, right? And you were talking about biology, and this is what we do. But maybe we are more than that. But we never demonstrated scientifically yet.
There's definitely a lot of work to be done there. It's like with the quantum fuzziness. So Heisenberg said that Heisenberg uncertainty. So it's very hard to measure at the same time both the distance. The location, and the movement of a particle with the same precision, and then if you add light, it disturbs the movement, so you can have a low energy light, but then the position is harder. So it makes me wonder, can we really talk about an objective reality without an observer? Because the observing obviously impacts the reality. So
exactly.
Is there a reality without an observer?
Yeah, that's the biggest koan. The koan in Buddhism, right? The koans in Rinzai Buddhism, you slowly go towards enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And the steps you make is like solving this kind of koans, what you just said. And the question that you put now, at this moment, we cannot solve it intellectually. Maybe we will. I don't know. It's just science is just beginning, right? But then you can meditate, and then you can try to get in contact with something that is transcends us, something that is much bigger than us. Maybe it's in that 96% that we don't know yet about the universe.
So would it be interesting that all the famous physicists in the world all start doing meditation retreats?
I think everybody should meditate. Yeah. Not only the physicists, not the scientists, not only scientists.
Even in companies, and companies should have like maybe an hour per day where they pay people to meditate.
We do here. Here also, it's once a week it works out to have a meditation session here. And it has a big impact. I mean, and just a simple exercise on breathing makes such a huge impact. And we were talking before that about post-stress syndrome, like veterans coming
post-traumatic
stress syndrome. And there is in Stanford, there is someone who deals with that. And actually, she started with is Emma Seppala, if I pronounce it correctly. And it's a center for altruism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard about.
And she started with 1 week with his soldiers, with the veterans, who have really big problems at home, with the family, with everything. Just 1 week of meditation and breathing, just proper breathing and few small yoga exercises. And this week had an enormous impact. Even after 2 years, they were healthy and had healthy relationships and they could sleep very well. And it's just by learning how to breathe.
I've seen similar research where they add an extra controversial opponent of MDMA, which is similar to ecstasy. And it kind of allows people with a post-traumatic stress to look with some love and kindness to themselves. And that way they can maybe even look with some love and compassion to the person that hurted them, maybe raped them. And it allows them to, in combination with the meditation, to have like real breakthroughs and to see things from another perspective and see that their pain is quite similar to love, actually.
Yeah,
this is probably the most hippie thing I ever said. So,
no, it's the thing is this reminds me of one of the things that Dalai Lama said when he started teaching in the West. What he was amazed is the fact that the Western people, they can say to themselves they are bad, that I'm not worthy, and Tibetans, they don't have that. The Tibetans never say to them, or the Buddhists, they never say to themselves, I'm a bad person.
Have you ever been to Tibet?
Not yet. To Japan, yes. Mm. To Japan, yeah. But they don't have that. And then we have this. So we have to start, when you start meditating, and when you start meditating on compassion, you first have to start with yourself.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you cannot help. And this is what you see with volunteers trying to help other people. Mm. A lot of them end up in burnout. And if you go deeper and you try to find out how did they reach in burnout, because they are givers without any limits, but they still didn't start with the first point, you know, start having compassion with yourself.
I have to take that home with me because I do a lot of volunteering at the moment, so... But I agree that self-compassion, strangely enough, it's one of the most difficult things in the world. We're always so hard on ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's
But it's very Western, this thing.
Yeah.
It's very Western. And you know, they ask Dalai Lama, you know, but you never did bad things. Don't you have any regrets? I said, of course I did. Of course I did. But you come to terms with it and you don't wipe it away. You just say, look, it is where it is. And
nice
it defines
sentiment.
Me. Like you said, you know, this pain is actually love for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gives you a lesson. It's just applying this the concept of equanimity. There are things in life that you're not proud of,
mm-hmm.
but it teaches you something. And you don't ignore it. And that's the thing with Buddhism. Buddhism is not an escape route like a lot of other things, a lot of other religions.
It's not like a magical painkiller.
And it's not a magical painkiller. On the contrary, it forces you to go into the black, dark corners that you have into yourself and get at peace with it. And then you can move on. But this step, indeed, this is the first step of having compassion with yourself. That's the toughest one for our Western society.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that Buddhism is, it's not just being peaceful and sitting and meditating. I think if you really start getting into it and really try to accept everything, there might be things that come up, they call them kleshas, that you probably don't want to look into. Maybe you have some childhood traumas that influence your decisions at this moment. And that's why I find the new research about psychedelic drugs really interesting, because you have, for instance, ayahuasca. It's something I did in the Amazon. It's a jungle plant which gives you hallucinations, and it allows you to go a bit deeper into things you don't really want to go deep in about. It kind of closes your filters, so things will come up whether you like it or not, and that way you can have real big breakthroughs, because you're finally, from a mindset of love and compassion, able to see things that have been holding you back maybe for years.
Yeah, I never tried it yet, so
you can do a company retreat to Peru. I'm sure there would be interested people
but what they say is also that the people who meditate and they do ayahuasca on top of it, that will give the biggest gain.
That's probably why I had quite a good effect, because I was already meditating a lot of time. I spent with my girlfriends 2 weeks in a little canoe in the Amazon jungle between the crocodiles. So that was a big retreat by itself. So we have this Buddhistic view called emptiness. And emptiness is the way that Buddhists try to explain everything. So I don't know, maybe you could elaborate a little bit on what is emptiness, or what is the fabric of everything according to the Buddhists?
That's a tough question. I mean, it's again another koan, that the purpose of the koan is to get into these kind of concepts that you cannot explain them intellectually, and that you try to realize them. And the answer to your question is, what I would say is that go and sit and meditate, and then you will reach this the understanding of the emptiness.
Sometimes when I meditate, I have like, wow, that was an amazing insight, and then I want to write it down, and it's not possible to write it down in any words whatsoever. And then I get frustrated, and then I'm frustrated now, there goes my meditation. So I think meditation is really the practice of letting everything be also like accept that you cannot understand everything, that you shouldn't. Things are already perfect as they are.
As they are, yeah.
So I brought a poem to the conversation.
Great.
I think it's a nice way to sound smart. And it's from William Blake. You might have heard it. It goes like this. To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
That's a beautiful one. I know it, yeah. It's it contains so many so many Buddhist concepts in it and so many physics concepts in it that it's, we can talk for hours. And since your podcast, the first one was 50 minutes, right? Let's try to see. So one, there are a few things that pop into my mind when I hear this, and one of them is you know, the last research that they've done is 2 weeks ago, public on the question was why when we grow older the time passes faster. Mm-hmm. And the answer was that when we are young, everything is new for us. Everything what we see is new. So you see, this is a flower I haven't seen. This is a city I haven't seen. And then mm-hmm. The kids are much more in the moment compared to us. But for us, we have so many experiences and we think we know everything. Of course, this is arrogant from us, but okay. But we just pass through life without noticing the little things, the little grain of sands, the little flowers. And then our time passes faster because we have much less impacting experiences in the same amount of time as a kid has.
We are like a little bit like zombies.
We are zombies.
Automatically go through and even act.
But somehow we evolve to be like this, right? With the old age that we become a bit of zombies. But we can do something about it.
It makes me think about behavioral economics because from an evolutionary perspective, it's not that interesting to really, like, when there's a tiger in front of you, to think, what would be the best thing I would do? It's good to have some shortcuts in your thinking and be irrational, but now we don't have tigers running around in Brussels anymore.
Sure.
So I think we should question our automatic thinking if it's really helping us all the time.
Yeah, and then if you try to be present in the moment, and this is one of the basic concepts in Buddhism, then in meditating, it's just meditating constantly. And then if you try to do this just for one day, you will see how much happier you are and how many more experiences, how many things you haven't seen yet on your way to work, just because you paid attention to small things.
And maybe it's a secret to living longer, because
it is, yeah.
Relatively speaking, it will feel like you have lived a lot longer. Another interesting topic now that we talk about living long is time. What is time? Does it inherently exist? Does it exist without a past and a future? Does the present moment even exist? What is it?
No, you can take this at several levels, but of course time is a construction that we as humans we made it, right? And it's very relative, as we know from Einstein and as we know from all these experiments that confirmed the special relativity. And so being so relative, depending how you look at it, and even the example I gave before, you know, just if you try to pay attention every moment of your life, every moment of your day, your time will expand. Like, but then the question is, if time doesn't exist, can we access other times, right? Can we, well, sort of travel in time? And one of the, there's a Romanian writer who wrote a lot about religions, so the history of religions, and he wrote a book, Sacred and the Profane, while mm-hmm. he was in the States already. And in one of the things, he answered one of the questions that I was struggling with. Why do we need rituals?
Okay.
I don't know if you had this question. It's like, you know, I mean, Zen is very simple.
You sit.
That's why it attracted me, Zen, because there are no rituals involved. I mean, okay, you just bow in the beginning mm-hmm. and at the end, but there's hardly any where you just sit. And then, whereas other parts of the world where Buddhism is practiced, a lot of rituals. So what, and especially the Western religions, a lot of rituals. And you know, so what is the role of rituals? Why do we have to? Why do we need these rituals? And he explained it in one page. He explained it, and then he said, "Look, we go through these rituals to this one point where we have full connection with our ancestors, And then you get the true meaning of religion or your practice or your meditation or your everything. And then I realized, indeed, a lot of people, or most of the people, need this to come to this point. You know, you need to slowly move into this one. And there are a lot of techniques. And of course, like in transcendental meditation, you have concentrating on your mantra and, mm-hmm. and you know, counting down, for example, in other mindfulness techniques. You need a sort of ritual to go down to that point.
The way I see it is you need a ritual to finally understand you don't need any ritual.
Exactly.
That everything actually already is... perfect as it
exactly.
is.
Yeah.
It's not changeable, so
yeah.
just let it be.
Let it be. Indeed.
Like John Lennon would say.
Yeah.
It makes me think of the concept of emptiness we have in Buddhism. So in Buddhism they say that everything, like the mind, is like an ocean. And our thoughts, our perceptions, whatever appears, it's like waves in the ocean. But the ocean is not the waves, and the fabric, the water of the ocean, is actually emptiness. It doesn't exist. It's like a mirror that allows everything to appear, but still, it is not like if an apple appears on the mirror is not an apple. It just appears as an apple. And I think that this concept of emptiness is very very interesting and peaceful, because once you start accepting that everything is kind of an illusion made up by your mind, you start to accept things more faster. Like it really doesn't matter. But then one danger of that is that, does anything really have a purpose? What is the purpose of living? And then we could fall into nihilism. You start to think, now when do we talk about, when is this motivational, or when is this actually nihilistic, and is it kind of demotivational that maybe nothing matters?
yeah, that's a good one. I think the nihilism, as we talked before, is something very close to our Western way of thinking, and it boils down to the ego. You know, why do we need something to drive us further? It's like you said, you know, it is how it should be, therefore there is no attachment, there is no desire, there is no, you just surrender to it, right? And nihilism is like, yeah, but I need a purpose, but what is I, right? I need. And then you have in Buddhism, you have several techniques to go beyond that point, to go to this transcendental point where you transcend your ego. And then when you reach that point, when you say, well, it is how it is, and then you go back and you sit again, and this is it.
I, from my experience, I think it's like a point you have to get past. Like it's,
yes,
you have some point during your meditation experience where it gets a bit tough, and then I think that's where the real value comes from. Maybe it might feel a bit nihilistic, but once you get beyond that point, it can be very yeah. meaningful, and you start appreciating, for instance, just seeing your girlfriend in the evening and that she's still alive, and how actually she's also impermanent.
Exactly.
And
because
you cannot, if we would all live forever, would we be able to appreciate anymore? It's probably because of the impermanence of ourselves.
Because of the impermanence, yeah. Yeah. And it's nice to start your day with being grateful for the things you have. And then you will see the total mind shift that you will have if you start your day by being grateful for what you have. Whatever, if it is gifts that you have, or if it's the persons that you met, or it's something that made you smile for the day. Just start your day like this.
I got free cookies at the station in Ghent today. I was very
wow.
grateful.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, then they said there was a lightning strike and the trains didn't go on, but still.
But, okay.
you should focus on the good part.
On the good part.
Yeah. Actually, now that I think about it, the lightning strike, lightning is also, lightning and weather is very interesting physically speaking, because there's like a new field of research, and they call it chaos theory, and it kind of like tries to explain why is it so hard to predict that there will be a lightning strike at this time at Ghent station. Like, why is it so hard? And then the thing is that even if you know all the rules of how the world works, still you can always find a more perfect way to define the initial conditions. And as long as you don't have a perfect view of the initial conditions, in the very far future, it's impossible to make precise conditions. And I think that's also some lessons to be taught from that for life, about predicting the future, and maybe our lives or even our minds is like the weather. It is very unpredictable.
Yeah, of course, and it's a choice. I think it's a choice you can make with like you said, with our mind, and then how we choose. Given this is one of the nice exercises that you can do in the beginning when you start meditating, when you start entering the Buddhism learnings, that you take a simple example from your daily life, and you look at it from the point of view, you look at it from a negative point of view. You say, look, I mean, there was a lightning, and then my train is delayed by half an hour. You can go and ruminate on that and say, well, yeah, but then I'm going to miss my meeting, which I had in Brussels at 11, and I'm going to be half an hour late, and this is going to
derail. The
universe will collapse, and I'm going to be late, and I'm not going to have lunch, and I'm going to be late back in Ghent. And so you can go on and on and on. Or you can say, well, wait a minute, maybe something is good from it. I get cookies from the persons who take care of us in a thing. Maybe I meet a nice person that is also late, and we can start a nice conversation. And everybody's has something in it that is passionate about it. Maybe you can learn something else. So if you try to do this in the beginning, just in the beginning of starting meditating, just to prime your brain into thinking positively, and then let the negative part, tag them and say, look, with something objective. You know, we have this word in English, judgment, which is in some languages is really a strong negative connotation. Also in Romanian is very, very strong negative connotation. But actually, to judge is to balance the pros and cons of something, to look at it from an objective point of view. So not putting a non-judgmental thing on something negative, and you leave it there. If it's something really tricky that you have to go through it, then you have to pass through that. You have to pass through this nihilism, what you were saying. You have to pass through these negative feelings that you have, and this is what Buddhism teaches you to go through. That is not wiping under the carpet and
no,
then
exactly.
It's gone.
Because I made that mistake the first time I meditated. I thought, oh, I think this should make me happy, but it makes me sad, and I don't want to be sad. But then you have to like be the space that allows, that like is the condition for the sadness. You just you let it be.
Yeah, and then you can once you prime your brain, and then you slowly change your brain, and neuroplasticity said you can do it, right? You you choose. You say, look, I have this goal, and then you choose this to be positive. You choose compassion. You choose self-compassion first, and then you choose compassion for the others, and you can enlarge the circle as much as you can. Imagine if everybody will have compassion with everybody that meets around the day. Imagine the politicians having compassion.
I had same idea that crossed my mind.
Imagine how a much better system we will have.
Yeah, like, let's take the topic of climate change. Like, people immediately, like, when there's two parties with obviously a different point of view, they don't, when the other party is speaking, they don't think, maybe he has a point there. Oh, maybe I should think about this a bit more before saying that he is wrong and how my idea is right. We immediately start attacking people. But then, what is the point of having a conversation if you only want to have this confirmation bias about your own ideas?
Exactly.
And think that not only other people are wrong with their ideas, but also there may even be bad people or worse people. If you come to a conversation with that mindset, which I've seen actually in companies as well happening from previous work experience, what's the point of meeting with each other?
And that comes to the first we discussed is this debating culture. We need to have a debating culture, accepting, being grateful for the others, to bringing critics, respectful critics, to your concept. Be grateful that you finally have someone challenging your idea and getting even better idea because we have this debate together. And then you can look at it from this point of view, that it makes your thinking much better, it makes the idea that comes about better, and if you put compassion on top of it, then you will get a much much better world. And it was nice. One of the last books I read was 21 Lessons for 21st Century.
I also read it from Yuval Wahari.
And one of the nice things he said, you know, is that before the Second World War, the world had three choices, right? Fascism, communism, and capitalism. After the Second World War, it remained to communism and capitalism. After the fall of the wall, we stayed with capitalism only. But now we mess it up. But there's no system now, there's no one to push another system. So we are a bit lost. It's like in Forrest Gump, and now what?
Yeah, it's like this immediate polarization of politics.
Yeah.
Either you are A or B, but meeting in the middle is just not acceptable.
Yeah, and then what now? I mean, we have nothing to choose from, so we are just chaotically fight with each other, have fake news and whatever. But what if we say, look, there is one thing that unites all of us, one thing, and that's compassion. No matter the culture, no matter the religion, no matter your background, nothing. Everybody has in itself compassion. So what if we had a total new world order, integral order, everybody compassionate?
Are you optimistic about that future?
Absolutely.
Do you think it's something that is going to happen in
Absolutely.
The near or distant future?
Yes, I truly am. And
I think also if we would ever live in that kind of a society, I think we really would have to need to change the political system. We
Everything.
Have to rethink, like you say, with the haponomy, the economy. Because, for instance, capitalism, you cannot look at it from a binary point of view. It's not good or bad. You have Bill Gates is a big capitalist. He's
Sure.
also probably one of the best human beings on this planet.
Sure.
He almost eradicated, what was the name of the disease? I think it was polio.
Polio, yeah. Well,
He solved problems in Africa where there's no drinkable water by actually allowing people to drink their own poo and extract water from it. So, and he is a very big capitalist. So I think the system is never the problem. It's like you say, it's a lack of compassion, I think, of the people in the system that is a problem.
Yeah, I truly think we can change this. And it's a matter of choice. You or choose for your own interest in being very individual, not seeing the link that you have with each other, like we discussed in the beginning, or you just compassion. And it's very easy. Compassion is everywhere the same.
Would you say that choosing for yourself is not also compassion? Because
depending
maybe
how you
it
do
is
it.
An extreme kind of manifestation of self-compassion driven by some internal neurosis or anxiety.
Sure.
Which doesn't serve you, but you're not aware of it.
Sure. I fully agree with you. But that's where we have to start. And then, like you said, you know, self-compassion first. And of course, you have to choose this first and then be on a growth path with yourself and make people aware this is possible. That would be nice.
Well, I have that quest with my podcast for sure, just to make people a little bit more conscious about themselves and make them question not only themselves, but also their role in an ecosystem, because you have an impact on the environment. You are kind of your environment in the end of the day.
You are the
economy. So instead of saying, this is bad, this is bad.
It's like driving to Brussels, right? Like driving to Brussels and complaining about traffic jam. You are the traffic jam.
Exactly. Right? And then talk with your employers. Yeah. And does it really bother you that I work from home? Isn't it better for everybody?
Yeah, the question is, when do you start? When do you start teaching this? And to me, it's like really start very early. Start at the kids. Why don't we have this in schools? Why don't we have this like the Swedes made it in the 19th century with these inner growth camps? Why don't we introduce this in schools? Why don't we teach meditation and compassion and what technology can do for you? Why don't we listen to the kids? How do they see the world?
Like, what kind of bothers me is that we have in our education system hours and hours, it must be hundreds of hours of religious classes. But we don't have 1 hour in our entire 18 years where we teach compassion, where we teach to how to stand up for ourselves, maybe where we're even teach to learn programming. For instance, if I would have 1 hour in my entire 18 years of programming, I wouldn't have studied physical therapy. I would have gone straight to computer science, which would have saved my parents quite some money and myself quite some agony and pain.
Okay.
So I want to change the subject a little bit now. So we've been talking a lot about physics and meditation and Buddhism. Let's take maybe a more exciting topic.
Even more than that?
Yeah, it's very hard, I agree. We can talk a little bit about artificial intelligence, or AI as people call it, because you work for Siemens, and your work, a lot of it involves AI, I understand. So I want to go a little deeper about that. So the first thing is, what is artificial intelligence? Because a lot of people think it is robots will take over the world in 2 years and we should stop it. But
a friend of mine sent me one of those memes from the internet. You know, if you write it in code, then it's machine learning. If you write it in PowerPoint, then it's artificial intelligence.
I have to remember that one.
Yeah, I will send it to you because it's brilliant. I've used it in presentations. So it's I'm doing artificial intelligence. So I'm not coding. I'm not doing any code. And I'm here based in Brussels and trying to see how Europe positions itself in artificial intelligence and globally. Working in a multinational with a global outreach, you know, and trying to see how we can link it to each other, and then trying to find the strong points for Europe for this. So what I see here in Europe, and we saw it in the last year, that Europe tried to position itself with a differentiator on ethics, right? And having a high-level group and so on. But is ethics everywhere in the world the same? Is not.
And
definitely not. So if we were to create an algorithm made in Europe, right, based on ethical guidelines and ethics from Europe, we will have a small market, right? We will have the European market. Unless we go for imperialism and we want to conquer the world with our values and so on. And you see the clash of values in a lot of events here in Brussels between US, China and Europe. So for me, it looked like, well, we have this rhetoric of negativity. We have this rhetoric of ethics and the good and the bad, and the big GAFAs are bad, and China is bad, and we are the best, and but everything is bad, and robots will take over, and you will lose your job, and so how to change this? You know, we need to change this rhetoric to something positive, and we have strong points in Europe, we have industrial strength in Europe, and we use artificial intelligence already for 30 years. And we can show that Europe is strong in several points, but we need to make people aware, including politicians, that there are strong points and there is a positive rhetoric to it. Mm.
I think from my experience, so I am more on the machine learning part, so the actual coding and not the PowerPointing.
The proper one, yeah.
Doing the hard work. from my experience, machine learning and artificial intelligence are things that are really hard to explain because it is really quite deep mathematics. And I think the job is also with the media is not to give us this oversimplistic view of what it is, because that's how you create fear. It's of course way easier to say AI is robots being more intelligent than us. It's easier article to write, but it's not the truth.
No.
It's clearly influencing policy.
Yeah, and then what I like to show is that, look, if you have a kid of 2 years old, right, and you show him one dog and you show him another dog, the third time he will see a dog, that's a dog. Mm-hmm. Right? If he can speak, at 2 years, they can speak quite okay. But then if with an algorithm, you have to show him 1.2 million pictures of dogs to say in the end, well, I have an accuracy of 80% that this is a dog, right? So this is where we are now. But nobody's aware this is where the technology stands. And so it makes no sense to have this science fiction fearsome...
We're not there yet.
We're
I
absolutely
don't think
not
we'll ever be.
Of course, you have the singularity point, and of course, you have all these theories that the super intelligence and so on. But we are not there yet. And it's up to us how we want to reach that point, right? And do we want to build it on our strengths and with a view on the people, making eponymy happening? Or do we choose to fall into this rat race again and against something, against other regions of the world, because we think we should be better and be competitive instead of working together to have something nice? And this is our chance now.
So the message is, again, compassion. If
compassion.
If I understand correctly,
compassion.
Everything is,
to me,
is
that's,
compassion.
That's, yeah, to me that's it. To me that's the answer.
So would you say that... robots, do you think they will ever have a consciousness? Do you maybe think they already have?
Once we found out what consciousness is,
if
you look at the strict definition of consciousness, right, it's just being aware of your environment. I mean, you can put sensors.
Maybe
you can put sensors.
Has consciousness.
Maybe a rock has consciousness.
Way.
Yeah. But a robot definitely has consciousness because it has. You can put all the sensors we know, and he can sense even more than we can sense. I mean, we see only a very narrow spectrum in light, whereas with a robot you can put that he can see much more, right? So in that sense, if you go for the strict definition, what we have now in consciousness, then yes. But
I think we tend to view consciousness from our own angle, but
yeah.
It's like this, it's the human being's ego again, but why would our consciousness be superior to the consciousness of a bunny? Maybe the bunny is a lot happier.
Well,
So I wanna finish off this conversation because I wanna respect your time, whatever time might be. I wanna go back again to the first question. So I asked you in the beginning, who or what are we? So now with all these things that we talked about floating around in your consciousness, how would you answer again, who or what are we, in a couple of sentences?
Yeah,
silence,
I think
your answer?
Maybe that's my answer. Yeah. Maybe
one.
Silence is an answer. Maybe just meditating on it is an answer. Yeah. Maybe just sit and meditate on this beautiful koan.
Because in the end, we have to think. We can think all we want about quantum physics, and we can feel smart about it, and we can think and read about meditation and feel spiritual. Always are good beings, but in the end, it has to be useful. Like, what would you say to listeners, like, these are topics we touched today, and I think because of this it can be really useful to you?
Yeah, what I would say is that when in doubt, making a decision, always choose compassion.
I think that's a very nice one. Okay, so I have a few more questions,
sure.
Just like very short ones.
Sure.
I tend to ask them to every guest. So the first one is, suppose every human being has a mailbox. You should write one message on a piece of paper and put it in every human being's mailbox. Like, mm-hmm. What short message would you...
This will be, when in doubt, choose compassion.
Okay, so that was an easy one. What has been your most grandiose failures? Like, some failure, which maybe was really hard for you, but you thought, like, now looking backwards, that was maybe one of the best things happening to me.
Wow. That's a tough question, actually. Because, you know, we look at failure from our point of view that it is a failure, seeing it from the definition of success, right?
Mm-hmm.
The definition of
you
success...
You cannot have the one without the other.
The definition of success that we have now is in Oxford Dictionary is reaching fame, status, and wealth.
Ah, that's...
That's the official definition.
I was about that.
So we look at success and we look at failure as the opposite of success, right? But if you look at success as reaching a life of happiness through compassion and well being as a human and being compassionate to the others, then these failures are just tools for you to grow towards that success. So basically nothing is failure then.
I agree.
So that's why I say it's a difficult question, because I looked at, of course you have moments in life where you say, I should have done it differently, but you learn so much from that.
Yeah, failure might not be the right phrasing.
Yeah, so depending how you, yeah.
So, final question,
sure.
Then I will let you be as it is. So, what book have you recommended most to other people?
Yeah, I have few I have my top books.
Okay.
So if you're looking for a funny book, then of course it's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, I think it's also on top of my list.
That's the top, and mm-hmm. that's the yeah, that's the humor I like, and that's the basis for so many scientific things and in AI as well, and you know. That's the one. If you want to understand society, and especially US, which is for us Europeans quite difficult to understand, then I recommend this, and especially also multinationals. I recommend Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged.
Okay.
It's an 1100 pages book.
It has been recommended to me before, but I never had the courage to tackle it.
And it's amazing. It's a must read from everybody. And this is not in a particular order, but if you... And then the other one is The Happiness of Mathieu Ricard.
Yes.
Which is the...
My previous guest, Lieven Annemans, also had high respect for Mathieu Ricard.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have him on the podcast as a final guest.
That would be amazing if you can get him.
That would be nice.
He's a scientific mind, and he's compassionate, and... you know, everything you would like to see this our societies to be, and humble, and
we should make him the world dictator, maybe.
Yeah, dictatorship. That's enough for another podcast. We can talk about it. Yeah,
exactly. So I want to thank you. I really enjoyed it. Was very nice to be able to discuss both physics and meditation. And AI in the same conversation. So I really appreciated it.
Many thanks to you.
I think you had many wise lessons to share. And maybe we will revisit this conversation later on, because I think we have other things left untouched. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks to you.
And that, unfortunately, was the end of a very interesting interview. It was, like I said before, very much in line with the interview with my previous guest, Professor Lieven Annemans, and I really encourage you to listen to that. And in the end, I hope you found something interesting, and maybe that you have something in your mind that you think, this might be something that I learned from this that I want to apply in my life. That would be really great if you have that. And if you have, please consider sharing it with your friends, because as you know, I am an autistic person and I am absolutely an idiot when it comes to empathy or marketing. So I'm really counting on my listeners to spread this podcast. Thank you. And I can already hear you. You're thinking, oh no, what if I miss another episode? This is so interesting. This is so life-changing. Well, fear not, my dear friends, because the best way to keep up with the latest episodes is to go to the 20angles.com website and subscribe to the newsletter. And in that way, I can give your email address to a lot of evil companies, and that way I can make some money. Besides that, if you are using a podcasting app like the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, Google Podcast, the best way to subscribe is just to click the subscribe button in these apps. All right, now I will let you enjoy your lives. I hope in a conscious way, not like a zombie, but as a conscious human being. And I will see you here for the next episode.